This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. In 1991, Nathan Bowie and his uncle killed two men, Nelson Shuford and Calvin Wilson. They did that outside an apartment complex in Catawba County. Bowie was 20 years old at the time. The crime is inexcusable. Bowie paid the ultimate price. He was convicted and sentenced to death. But Bowie's original attorney was a self-confessed alcoholic who never presented much of a defense. The prosecutor even offered Bowie a plea deal for second-degree murder, but the attorney never fully discussed that with his client. Now Nathan Bowie is seeking clemency from Governor Bev Perdue. He's been on death row for 20 years. Alex Charnes took up his cause 18 years ago, and he is with us today. Alex Charnes, welcome to the State of Things. Good afternoon. Let's start with the crime itself, the night Nathan Bowie committed those murders. There's no question of his guilt, right?
No, he's guilty, and this is basically the refrain from a song, Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Here there were guns. Everyone had guns. Mr. Wilson had shot at Nathan's aunt and uncle the night before.
As one of the victims.
One of the victims. Yeah. And Nathan was told that both men or one of the men had raped his aunt, Rochelle. And the next day, under the haze of drunkenness and drugs, Nathan went with his uncle, who's 10 years older, William. And this was a misguided defense of family or a defense of family honor. And those two men were shot. And what I have to say, it isn't an excuse for that crime. It was a crime. The question is, you have actual innocence of the crime, and then you have something that it doesn't really work to call it the innocence of the death penalty, but it's something like that.
Because obviously there are a variety of crimes he could have been charged with, and certainly sentencing, there's a range of sentences. So now tell us about the sentencing phase and his attorney.
Yes. Well, Nathan is now 41 years of age. He was 20, as you said, when the crime was committed. And if you think about Atticus Finch, and the type of lawyer that we would all like to represent ourselves when we're in trouble or our loved ones, and think of the polar opposite, and that's Thomas Portwood. Thomas Portwood had been an alcoholic for 30 years when he got Nathan's case. And the way things worked back in the battle days in North Carolina, judges would appoint the lawyers in just about every case. And in this case, Thomas Portwood was appointed to represent Nathan. And as I was driving over today from Durham, I saw the highway patrol pass me, and I wondered, I have this fantasy that if in the courtroom back in 1993, we had a lawyering while intoxicated checkpoint, and Thomas Portwood had to take a breathalyzer before he got in the courtroom, that Nathan wouldn't be here, I wouldn't be talking to you, because Mr. Portwood, during the course of the representation, once he had an accident, his blood alcohol level was 0.40. 0.08 is legally drunk. Wow. 0.40, the average person would be killed by that blood alcohol level. Another time, actually after the representation, he had another DWI, and again, it was a blood alcohol level that would kill the average human being. But his alcoholism was so advanced that he could drink massive amounts of alcohol. Of course, he couldn't provide adequate representation, and that's the problem here. Mr. Portwood was actually approached by the bailiff in the courtroom in Nathan's case, and the bailiff was the deputy sheriff, Mr. Ledford, and Deputy Sheriff Ledford had lived at this boys' home where Nathan had lived. And this was important because on the to-do list of the lawyers was to interview folks from the Sipes Orchard Boys Home where Nathan had lived 6 years of his life. And to try to have someone receive a life sentence as opposed to the death sentence, the lawyer's job is to humanize their client. And that's something that could take hundreds of hours to do if you do the job right. Well, back then, in this case, Mr. Portwood and a young lawyer just out of law school spent 3 hours.
Well, so why would that have been relevant anyway, his time at that boy's home?
Well, it was relevant because the prosecutor in the closing argument pointed out that Nathan didn't have anyone from the boys' home come to testify, so he must have been an awful character, that he couldn't find one person that knew him best during those 6 years. Well, Deputy Ledford actually was a house parent, knew Nathan, and there he is in the courtroom, and you can imagine going ahead and pulling on the coattails of the alcoholic lawyer who very well was impaired at this time, saying, "I can testify, I know Nathan, he's a good kid. I was a house parent.
Not only that, but he was sexually abused at that home. He was sexually abused throughout his life, even before he got to that home.
Well, he grew up in poverty, and that's how he ended up in the boys' home. His mother had a number of children. She was an alcoholic and a drug addict and had serious, serious problems, such that it was worked out with Department of Social Services that Nathan would live at the Sipes Orchard Boys' Home, which was seen at the time as a very good place to live, and that's how the prosecutor portrayed it to the jury. But in fact, this prosecutor had signed off on a plea bargain for one of the house parents who had sodomized two of Nathan's friends and worked out a plea deal, and this was all kept out of the papers. This was back in the late 80s. And so Nathan slept with a stick, a giant stick, under his bed. He called it his protector. And one of the people that Nathan's attorney should have called to testify at a sentencing hearing was a woman named Lydia Anglin. She was a Native American. She was like a surrogate mother for Nathan. She actually took Nathan to Oklahoma for a tribal reunion. And Nathan played football with her sons, and they loved Nathan. The jury heard from a football coach, assistant coach, the principal, a teacher from way back when, social worker who wasn't interviewed before she was put on the stand. She was just put on the stand. The lawyers didn't get the social services record, so they had no idea what to ask the social worker. They hadn't talked to Nathan's mother in any substantial way before they put her on the stand. Nathan's sister, who has since served our country in Iraq, wasn't interviewed. No family member was actually interviewed in any substantial way.
And the interesting thing is that this does not mitigate his guilt, of course. Anything about his abuse, sexual abuse, his poverty, or the fact that a lot of people liked him has nothing to do with his guilt. It simply has bearing on what kind of sentence he'll get. And this is what the attorney failed to bring to the attention
right.
of the court.
And what happens in, I call it the rigged calculus of death. You have aggravating factors that entitle you to be sentenced to death. And then you have statutory mitigating factors that the jury is required to consider as something in the favor of the person that has been convicted of murder. And one of these factors is age. And so you'd think, well, 20 years old, that would qualify him for this age mitigator, something that the jury would have to consider in whether they put him to death. Well, the North Carolina Supreme Court says, well, it's more than just chronological age. You could have immaturity. Is he an alcoholic? Does he have a drug problem? Does he live in poverty? This would be a fairly easy statutory mitigator for Nathan's case, because he was an alcoholic from the time he was a very young boy. He also used drugs, and he was immature in the ways that go beyond a teenage boy. But instead, the prosecutor portrayed him as someone that was actually a leader, that he led his older uncle around, that the alcoholic trial lawyer also became the alcoholic appeal lawyer. So on appeal, you have someone who has no business handling a trial or even handling a traffic ticket, much less actually doing a brief that was one of the most pitiful briefs I've seen submitted to the North Carolina Supreme Court.
Let's look at a couple of factors here. Number one, how does a guy like this get appointed? It seems to me the court must have known. Everybody in that courthouse would have known this guy's case. I mean, he's had a couple of DUIs. Why does a judge appoint a guy like this to a case?
There's the conspiracy of silence in a small town, and I'm sure it happens in bigger towns as well. But now you have a capital defender who statewide appoints competent attorneys. This exact thing couldn't happen anymore in North Carolina with the new system we have. But back under this bad old system, you know, your buddy from the country club appoints you. And this is a very lucrative practice. And
well, what about Nathan? I mean, I would think it would be obvious to him as well. Can he fire him and hire a better attorney?
Nathan, from his background of poverty and really knowing that the system is rigged, this is a young man who is dealing with a white attorney who's connected to the power structure in his small town. His attorney goes to the country club. He knows the judge. He's been around a while. Nathan comes from the wrong side of the tracks. He's extremely poor, and he went from his home to foster homes, and then he's at the Sipes Orchard Boys home, and what he knows there is the N-word is thrown around regularly. The kids are physically assaulted and raped by the house parents. They're convicted, and none of this ends up in the papers or is even known, and that here's the prosecutor arguing that this was a great place to live. In fact, the jury found that Nathan's 6 years at the Sipes Orchard Boys Home was not a mitigating factor. That wasn't something in his favor because it was such a great place to live. So none of this was presented to the jury. And one of the things about capital punishment, whether one agrees with it or not, is that you should know the human being you're sentencing to death. This jury did not know Nathan Bowie, the human being. They knew his crime, surely. They knew the crime of his uncle, but they didn't know what brought him to that point. And for that failing, I'm asking the governor to grant clemency for Nathan and really for everyone else on death row, everyone else that had these attorneys back in the battle days when they weren't competent to actually provide capital representation.
Is clemency the only route for him? Is there a method through the legal process that could at least overturn the sentence because of his poor representation?
No. We've tried all that. In fact, once we found out that Thomas Portwood, on his deathbed as he's dying from alcohol-related diseases, basically his hospice nurse, heard his deathbed confession that he drank on the way to court, before court, after court, and in the evening would pass out. At the hearing, when we were challenging Mr. Portwood's representation, Mr. Portwood perjured himself and lied and said, I would drink in the evening half a fifth of vodka, and by the morning I was fine, and I would go to court. I never drank before I went to court. So when we tried to amend our habeas corpus petition in federal court, the judge says, oops, you were late. You missed it by a couple months here. Sorry, counselor, we're not going to consider the fact that Mr. Portwood admitted on his deathbed that he was drunk, and that it makes it pretty likely that he perjured himself in this hearing. And that's the way the court system is set up. You get your chance. If you're poor and you get the alcoholic lawyer that's friends with folks that keep his secret, then you're not going to get good representation, and things only get harder as you go along. Once you get to federal court, they say, well, the state court already decided that this age factor doesn't apply. We can't look at that again, even though the federal ruling said, well, he's immature, he's an alcoholic, he has a drug problem. Clearly this age factor applies, but we don't go back in time. We don't have time travel. Sorry, counselor, you were late. We're not going to consider this. So now we've been up to the Supreme Court twice, and there is no challenging the sentence except through the Racial Justice Act, which Judge Weeks down in Cumberland has granted relief to a couple inmates, and that's great. And actually they cite Nathan's case, some of the racial comments the prosecutor made in his case, they cite in the 200-page opinion granting life without parole to other folks on death row down in Cumberland County. So that's a possibility, but the reason we're asking Governor Perdue to do something, Judge Weeks' opinion surely will be appealed up to the North Carolina Supreme Court, the Supreme Court of North Carolina. Hopefully they'll uphold that decision, but this is a case where Some people told me, you're wasting your time, just save your breath. Governor Perdue isn't going to grant clemency to Nathan Bowie.
Well, and certainly she's looking at a lot of clemency requests right now, I would assume. What distinguishes this case, or I think I heard you just say she should grant clemency to all of those requests.
I think she should, and I think you can still have a death penalty, but have lawyers who actually represent their clients. This is the 50th anniversary of Gideon versus Wainwright, the U.S. Supreme Court opinion that said in serious cases that the accused should have counsel. Nathan Bowie didn't have counsel. In some respects, the counsel that he had is responsible for him being on death row, not as an excuse for the crime, but that we expect our lawyers to have a minimal level of competence. And here we didn't. This was a travesty and really is a shame.
Any indication from the governor's office what she might do with this case?
No, not anything. But in this advent, getting ready for Christmas season, and I'm looking for the Christmas star and don't expect anything, but I have hope.
Alex, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Alex Charnes is an attorney and represents death row inmate Nathan Bowie. That's our program for today. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can hear archived editions of our past programs at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is directed by Alex Granados, produced by Sean Wen, Nicole Campbell, and Dave DeWitt. Robin Copley and Al Wadarski are our engineers today. Brent Wolf is our news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you for being here.